Well, I'm very excited for this episode of the podcast. I get to have somebody on who I've been watching since I think my middle school days of YouTube, Mr. Mark Ellis, who's a comedian, gym rat, and the co-founder of the Schmodown. Mark, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Andrew. Thanks for that intro that makes me feel my years, as it were. I also like my best credit is my punctuality, which you know is just a facade because I'm like an hour late to this thing. So I'm sorry, but I'm here and I'm thrilled to be a guest on your show.
No, I'm so happy to have you. I think this has been a long time coming. I first reached out to you a year ago, I think, when I was writing for my college newspaper, roughly, and I was trying to get you for an article that we were doing about live performances. And the reason for this was because you were doing a virtual stand-up show, right? Was this, do you
I
remember
did a
this?
couple virtual shows during sort of the height of the pandemic. If we're looking at the last 2 years as a time capsule, then it would have been the first year of that. So I kind of realized that, back at the beginning of the pandemic, we're all like, all right, well, we'll be wearing masks for a couple of weeks, then it'll be fine. And then it just ended up being a lot more than that. And we needed to find ways to entertain ourselves. And so I and a lot of other comics started doing these virtual shows where it's either from your apartment, or in my case, I did a few by booking venues where there was a skeleton crew. It was just a couple, backstage sort of crew members, a couple of my friends opening for me, and then me basically doing an hour on stage for no crowd. It was like a TED talk, and but it was all that we could really do as comics at that time in the world of stand-up. And so it did satiate a need. And I think I got a couple like useful chunks of material out of that that's now working in front of live crowds. So it was actually, it was a fun exercise that night, but it also ended up being somewhat productive to, new stuff that I'm working on.
Well, how much of a bummer was that for you? Because you also released a stand-up special, right? Was that in 2019? Was that 2020?
2019 was the end of 2019 was Dog Stepfather. And then as soon as your special comes out, all that material is sort of burned because people have seen it for the most part, at least you think they've seen it. And so then you just want to work on the next hour. And so that's what I was busy honing. And then the world stopped. And as far as like how tough it was at the beginning, it wasn't so much like an emotional, I'm crying my eyes out every night because I can't be on stage, because there were a whole lot of people that had it a lot worse than I did. I was very lucky, to be honest with you, because I had a life that I could still do a lot of my shows virtually, not stand up, but I could still host a lot of my other stuff that I do from my apartment. So it was just me and the dog kind of hanging out. But I think what I was able to do was sort of turn my brain off to that, unsatiable appetite that all comedians have to get on stage every night. You realize it's not going to be coming around for a few months, maybe even a year. And so you just sort of do your best to turn that switch off. And every so often I would just, kind of drift and daydream about what it was going to be like to be back on stage for the first time in front of people. I would still write some material or jokes that came to me from time to time. But, for lack of a better word, a lot of the stand-up momentum that I had built to that point, I kind of put the brakes on for the better part of a year.
And so how did you test out jokes then if you didn't really have a crowd? I mean, you had a small crew there, so I guess you had some laughs if jokes were funny, but yeah.
For the virtual shows, I will say that the best thing, the most important, vital part of the crew and the opening acts were, it wasn't their jokes or it wasn't their technical prowess. It was just them, even just throwing like a tiny giggle, just hearing some sort of noise to keep you going to the next bit. Because again, like most of this stuff was new. And so I hadn't said it into a microphone before. I kind of had to act it out a little more than I usually would by myself in my apartment. But you never really know how it's going to go until you get up there. And so just having the ever so slightest amount of feedback was crucial, because that's what separates stand-up from everything else, is that we want that instant approval or disapproval so we can pivot one way or another. And without that, it turns into something else that I don't really want to go back to.
Yeah, it is a lot different than even music, right? Because with jokes, you need to have that instant reaction, as you just said. And so I just thought it was funny. I did want to wrap it back to to the way I reached out to you, which was via your DMs. And you have, thousands and thousands of followers on all your social medias. Why do you keep an open DM? I just find that so, I couldn't believe that. And then to actually get a response was just, it made me laugh more than anything.
Yeah, I just feel like the open DMs thing has just always been sort of a calling card of wanting to still have a line in the sand between, you know, fans and people who I'm actually friends with in real life. But I don't really put a lot of my, I put some of my real life on social media, but I think a lot of that is to interact with fans. That's what it's for. We're like my friends in real life, we can have conversations, we can text, we can call each other. For social media, it is a way to, you know, sort of have fans be able to reach out to if they need something. I obviously can't get back to everyone that you know, for lack of a better term, slides into my DMs, but I do like to have it open, especially when there's certain times in the world when, you know, like you pointed out, I have most of my fan base is younger than I am. And so they're probably going through something for the first time that I've been through multiple times, whether it's experiencing something tragic or it's something elating, or it's just the pandemic, or it's a movement, or there's just something frustrating going on in the world and people want to know how to handle it and approach it. I like to be there for people who've supported me. You know, I mean, if you buy a ticket to my show, you have a special place in my heart, and I want to honor that sort of commitment, that contract.
Yeah. Well, and I think the big thing I noticed with the Schmodown community, for example, is it seems like a very tight-knit community and a very caring community. And there does seem to be some connection between, you know, all the on-screen personalities that you had and the, you know, and the viewers, I guess, because I remember, you know, I used to watch SCN Live all the time and stuff. And just I thought that was so unique. I don't think you see that same level of interaction on other channels.
Yeah. And I think that's just the way that the show has been built. That's the way that the Schmoes Know show was built back in the day. And now with the Movie Trivia Schmodown, Christian and I are very cognizant of the fact that we literally don't have a show without fans, because we're both stand-up comics at heart. That's where Christian had his roots. That's obviously what I still do for a living. And so we, I think more than anybody else who's a performer, realizes the need to have people there, because even if it's just doing movie trivia, if nobody's watching it, in our opinion, we don't really consider it worth doing. If it's not for entertaining the masses, then why are we doing this in the first place? And so I think that we want to let fans know how much we appreciate them. And I think that adds to sort of close-knit community. And then you also have all these folks that started out as fans of the show who just watched it, who now are either competitors or they're part of a crew, they're hosting next to me. And so there's a lot of opportunity out there for people who came up watching the show and now they're like, hey, I think I can do that. Well, I think the Schmodown is a testament to you can be a fan of something, that's your origin story, but you can end up being a part of it if you put your mind to it.
Yeah, well, I think that's actually, you know, something great you said, because I would watch you on Movie Talk, as I mentioned, and I do want to talk about that, but I think that is a good example where that's also where I saw Jeff Snyder, who's somebody that now I talk to, you know, and he's helped me through, you know, a lot of stuff. And seeing, again, it's the same kind of thing, like I grew up watching you guys, and now I can do what you guys do, not to the same degree yet, but it's amazing to kind of see that now I'm talking to you. But as the host of Movie Talk, I wanted to ask you, do you remember how long you did that for? Like what were the years for that?
Oh, it feels like decades, Andrew. I was brought on board as a panelist back when John Campia was still hosting AMC Movie Talk, is what it was called initially. And then they made the move to Collider. And then I was just kind of along for the ride. Still was the new guy at that time. And so I would pop into the show a few times a week and we'd just talk about the movie news of the day. And then when John made the decision to step away from Movie Talk, we sort of had a communal host where some days it would be one person, a couple days a week it'd be me, and then other folks. And then either by proxy of, and I really don't know the answer to this, if it was Collider, the brass seeing something in me where they wanted to make me the everyday host, or it was just the others that just didn't feel like doing it, I was like, sure, I'll do this. This sounds like a good gig. And so I ended up settling into it pretty well. I liked it. I liked having that sort of, you know, daily dose of just being in people's lives. It was sort of the closest thing that I'll ever get to hosting Sports Center, you know, and movies, unlike sports, I sort of like being able to talk about them. Whereas with sports, I always wanted to keep sports like a hobby because I'm a huge sports fan, but I never wanted sports to feel like a job for me. I kind of realized that that's my escape. And with movies, I enjoy having that as an escape, sure, but also as just the job that sort of has been the connecting tissue of this community. And so if it doesn't matter where you and I come from, if we can have a bond about movies, then it's a pretty solid foundation for a relationship.
Yeah. And can you talk about the difference between, you know, doing stand-up versus hosting? Because, you know, you're funny as a host, but I think the biggest thing I noticed was your segues and transitions. And my friends can thank you for, because I'll just do awful transitions that are not, you know, when we're in like a PlayStation party or something. But that was always my favorite thing was, you know, how you go from one topic to another. Sometimes it'd be the most, you know, outrageous things. I was trying to look back and find some. I couldn't find any offhand, but... Yeah,
they just happen, you know, and to be perfectly honest with you, a lot of that is the sports background, because I've never like taken a hosting class or anything like that. From an early on in my life, I would watch sports and I would see not just like what's happening on the field, but what the announcers are doing, how they're introing the action, how they're moving it along, how they wrap things up, how they're able to come in and out of commercial breaks with ease. Mm-hmm. So you watch somebody like Al Michaels and how he's able to handle all of these responsibilities. That's sort of my approach to movie talk, is that you have to throw it to this panelist for this, and then you want to make sure that everybody gets their equal say about whatever story we're talking about. And then it's my job to take all of that and wrap it up into a nice bow, whether they said something that I completely agree with, whether it's something that I vehemently disagree with, or it's a spicy take that I didn't see coming. That's my job, is to make it presentable to the audience, to give it a nice intro and a nice outro and just captain the ship. And so I take that responsibility pretty seriously, and I do find it, I don't know that there's one that's easier than the other, because by this point in my career, I'm really not good at anything else. So I'm just happy that I can do anything competently in the world of hosting or stand up, because believe me, you do not want me fixing your car. Although I think I could, you do not want me working on it. If you find me under the hood of your car, you probably want to get an Uber, because it's not going to be drivable.
Well, and then I remember you did transition from movie talk to doing stand up, right? Was that the next step that you took?
I actually began my career as a comic. That's what I always wanted to be, since really I gave up my dream of playing in the NBA. So I moved out to LA in the early 2000s, just with the dream of, you know, let's do a bunch of open mics, sleep on my buddy's couch, which I ended up doing for a few months, and then seeing where that could get me. And it's like a massive video game where you just get to the next level and you just keep matriculating, and sooner or later you end up getting regular spots at a few clubs and getting to go on the road and getting to do some TV appearances and do a special and all these cool things. And along the way, you meet friends that can offer other opportunities. You meet folks that can audition you for things, and you find things that you like doing inside the world of entertainment, but that aren't stand-up, like reviewing movies for Schmoes Know or talking about movie news with Movie Talk. And so it's everything that I've done in my career has been predicated from fertilizing the stand-up comedy seed. So I still believe that if you can do stand up, then you have a leg up on anybody else who's doing anything else that's performance related in the world of entertainment.
And I do want to ask, how, you know, did you go to college? I guess that's my first question. My other question was going to be, how do you like, well, because no, that sounds like a, you know, but
I didn't, it's a very fair question, given what I do for a living. The answer is surprisingly, yes, I do have a degree from Wake Forest on the shelf somewhere. It's not displayed, but there is a communications degree from Wake Forest. I did make it through 4 years and had a blast. Probably, you know, wasn't the most worthwhile investment on my parents' part, but I got the degree.
Well, can I ask you what your communications department was like in college? If you, you know, if you really remember, because I'm actually in my school's communications department, and it's always like, to me, it's like the weirdest department we have here, I think. But I'd love to hear your experiences, if you know, have any.
Yeah, it is sort of a nebulous description for a major, right? Like, if you say you're majoring in journalism, okay, I get what you're doing. If you're majoring in biology, I know what you're talking about. With communications, it's like, well, are we talking more like the statistical, the data side? Are we talking about the technological side? Is it just the interpersonal part of communications. And so that was what always spoke to me the most was, you know, you have a message and you have a messenger and you have a recipient, and how does that work? How can the message get diluted? How can you get your message across? And then once we were able to sort of select which field of communications that we wanted to focus in, public speaking just spoke to me because I felt like I thought I could be pretty good at it. I guess had a irrational confidence about it. And that's the one skill that I guess I just got lucky that I was born with, is that I never really got stage fright, like giving speeches or anything. And so I think that I knew, at least when I was doing stand-up, and I did bomb horribly for a long time, but at least I was never knee-knockingly nervous before I went up. And that was, some of that was based in my experience from giving speeches in class, where, I mean, you're not necessarily, the goal certainly is not to be funny if you want to get an A, but I would always try to pepper in a few jokes in there. So my speeches, even the serious ones, had more of a wedding toast feel to them, but you know, I passed. I don't know that I got straight A's, but I passed.
No, but that's, you know, that makes sense though. Public speaking, and then now you're a stand-up comic. I think it does have more relation than you're giving it credit for.
Certainly there's things that you can, because again, when I was giving a speech, even more important to me than the grade that I was going to get, there was a letter, was how I was impacting people in the room. And the easiest way to gauge that is if you say something you think is funny, if the room laughs, oh man, there's no better feeling on earth. It's like seeing a basketball swish through the net after you shoot a deep three. It's so great. But I remember another time I was giving a speech, which this is not going to surprise you at all. We had to pick a character to give a speech about. And so naturally I picked Rocky Balboa, and I was talking about Rocky, and I guess not everyone was aware of the Rocky series as a film franchise. That's maybe rooted loosely in history, but it's a fictional character. So I'm talking about the beginning of Rocky IV, and I don't say the beginning of a movie because I'm approaching it like Rocky's a real guy. And so I said that he decided to avenge his friend's death by fighting Ivan Drago, who knocked out and killed Apollo Creed in the ring. And when I said that, this poor classmate of mine, the look on her face was horrified, like, oh my God, this guy killed a guy in the ring. And I was thinking, like, wow, if you believe this is true, that's having an impact on you. Like, this is some serious stuff if you don't know it's fiction.
Yeah. Well, no, that is really funny. I don't know. I'm surprised though, because Rocky IV is such an iconic movie. Although
I know.
I don't know. Like, you said that, then I thought you were gonna say maybe Rocky V, which I could forgive people for not remembering. You know, like the alley fight at the end. But you know, Rocky IV, I thought like the poster image, I thought that's like iconic. You know, I thought
you would think so. It's certainly more than George Washington Duke and his exploits in Rocky V. So yes. As if you and I agree on nothing else, we know that Rocky IV is better than Rocky V. That's good enough for me.
Yeah. And well, another thing we agree on are, well, for the most part, NFC East opponents. I'm a Giants fan. You're a Washington fan. I am aware of that, right? The Commanders.
That's
now
a hell of a segue you just had, Andrew.
I know. I'm trying. I tried my best there. But I did want to ask you about that. Did you grow up in like Washington, D.C. or anything like that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm an Air Force brat. My old man was in the Air Force he was born up in near Boston in Cambridge Hospital, but then they quickly moved down to DC because my grandfather was in the Navy. And so, long story boring, we did move around a lot to different coasts of the United States, but we were always sort of Washingtonians at heart. And so like Oxon Hill and like inner city DC, and then Columbia, Maryland, and Rockville, Maryland were a little bit later on at different spurts. We had a Florida in there. We had a California in there. And then when my dad got out of the Air Force, we settled in Williamsburg, Virginia. So even there, you're only like 2.5 hours from DC. And more importantly to us, the Washington Stadium. So we'd go to RFK to see the games, and just been a huge, huge Washington, now Commanders fan, since the day I came out of the womb.
So how do you feel about their stadium? Is it still FedEx Field? These names now change a little bit more frequently than I would like. Is it FedEx?
It is still FedEx Field, and they're looking to secure all the zoning properties and all that good stuff to build a stadium in downtown DC that they want to sort of feel like old RFK, because, you know, FedEx Field at the time it was built was a bigger stadium, and I guess it was somewhat state of the art, but it's nothing like the modern stadiums that you get now. Like I live in LA now, and so I'm in the shadow of SoFi Stadium, which is just this palace of technology. It looks like an Apple store, you know, just on steroids. And so FedEx Field is now turned into an ancient relic of modern day NFL. And it's weird to say that because, again, like it was opened in 97. And so I still feel like, you know, as you get older, you feel like, oh yeah, 97, that was a few years ago. And it's like, oh my God, it was 25 years ago. So, you know, unfortunately the last 25 years since FedEx opened have not been particularly kind to Washington. Our new owner at the time, and now our decades long owner, has had a lot to do with that, in my opinion. But at least we have a new name now and we're rebranded, and I don't have to feel shame walking the streets, repping my team anymore. At least shame in the sense of, you know, racial and societal equality. I still feel my fair share of shame with how the team performs, but I'm always optimistic. Even if you deal me a quarterback like Carson Wentz for $28 million, I'm still going to be optimistic about my squad and our chances to win, as you know, Andrew, all too well, the garbage division that currently is the NFC East.
Yeah, and I did want to, my roommate's also a Cowboys fan, so in this room, well, in the Zoom, and my between this and my room, where three of the four NFC East teams are represented, only one of them is really decent. But with the Commanders, I did want to ask you if, did you have to buy new merchandise? Because did you buy all the football team stuff when they were in their transition from, you know, their previous name to football team to now Commanders?
There's a reason why I went into stand-up and not financial investment. And one of those glaring reasons would be that I dropped a pretty penny on Washington football team merch. And then when the Commanders had their unveiling, I was one of the first online to get some new Commanders merch. So I didn't go too crazy yet. I got a sweatshirt, I got a shirt, I got a hat, and I got another shirt to kind of work out in. So I got four pieces of apparel, and then we'll see how the team does. And I haven't ordered any specific jerseys yet. I haven't done that in a while, just because free agency sort of, as soon as you buy a jersey, then it's like, oh, well, now Chase Young is playing for someone else. Hope he spends his whole career in Washington. I have no idea.
And so are you a jersey guy? I was just going to ask you. I feel like that's something I grew out of, you know, 5 years ago. I just like, I can't bring myself to spend $100 on a name that might not be there.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, maybe you get to a point in your life when you're like, why am I doing this? Why can't I just be an adult? And I don't know why that is. Like, why am I so prideful that I can't wear somebody else's name on the back of my shirt? So I'd be happy to go into a sports bar next year and having like a Heineke. I don't think I'm going to get a Wentz jersey, but I'd love having, you know, a Heineke or a Terry McLaurin jersey or something like that. But I haven't done it in a while. Used to be a big jersey guy, to answer your question. And still, if you go to my mom's house in Virginia, there are a ton of very now severely old Washington jerseys in there. There's Gus Frerotte. There's Terry Allen. There's Deion Sanders when he played for us. There's John Riggins. There's Daryl Green. So there's a whole lot that I have. But the jersey I get the most run out of now is probably my Tim Duncan Spurs jersey because, you know, Timmy's the top 10 all-time player, and we're both Wake Forest guys. So I feel like I can pull that one off.
Do you walk around with just the basketball jersey on, or do you wear like a hoodie underneath? How do you wear that?
Depends on the weather, man. I get cold easy, but if I'm going to go hoop, then it's just Timmy and my bare sleeves.
That's fair. And I think, now that I think about it, the reason I stopped buying jerseys is because the last one I bought was a Daniel Jones jersey. I think this was his rookie year. And I think they were on sale for like 80 or 90. I think it was 90. Okay. I'm not gonna give myself that much credit. But after a year, I then sold it for 75 on eBay because I just wasn't that confident. I'm like, maybe he won't. Somebody bought it. So, I mean,
yeah,
it, you know, it wasn't that much of a loss, but I was so excited his rookie year. It was like, oh, we have Eli 2.0 because that's my favorite player of all time. And then it's just gone downhill since. And
we Eli's just that guy who would always, I don't care what his stats say, he would always show up when it mattered the most. Yeah. And then, because I was with you, like I liked both Daniel Jones and Dwayne Haskins going into that year. And so I flirted with the idea of buying a Dwayne Haskins jersey, but I did not. And I think that was probably wise on my part in retrospect. But Daniel Jones, I there's so much potential there. I just, at some point, it's a little bit like with Carson Wentz. It's like I've seen the potential. I've seen what you can do that's good, but have you just been beat up so much physically and emotionally that you're sort of rattled and beyond the point of no return? I think Wentz is closer to that than Daniel Jones is, but who knows what the future holds.
Yeah, and I'm not going to harp on the guy too much because I'm not a professional NFL quarterback, but the only thing that made me laugh about Carson Wentz was when that report came out that he was, you know, difficult to coach or whatever with the Colts. And I think the Eagles said the same thing. And I'm like, well, he hasn't been good. He hasn't had a great season in, what, 5 years now or something, you know, or 4 years, something. Whenever he tore his ACL, I don't. You know,
he had a good
just,
run in 2017,
that's what it
and
was.
That's the guy that I got, Andrew. That's what I'm telling myself all off season. That's the guy that's going to show up week one. It's 2017 Carson Wentz. It's fun to live in my la-la land.
Yeah, well, I won't make you think too much more about the Commanders, but I did want to talk about another, you know, of your personality traits, for lack of a better term, is you're a big Van Halen fan. I remember, you know, I think there were a lot of references throughout movie talk on of Van Halen, and you know, I want to say I'm not a big fan. I just haven't listened to them. So if you were to give me five songs that I should listen to, I will say their version of Pretty Woman was on my summer playlist. So that one,
yeah.
I do have. But other than that, I don't know their music that well.
I can say that you've come to the right place. And this is, it is one of my passions. And it's just for no other reason. That music just makes me happy. It just makes me feel good. It's the perfect blend of everything that rock music was put on this earth to do. You get a little bit of the roots of rock and roll with the blues, but more so than anything else, it's what, if fun had a soundtrack, that's what it would be, is Van Halen music. It's celebratory, it's energetic, it's youthful. You know, 40, 50 years on from the band's first album, it still feels as fresh as it did back when they debuted with Van Halen 1 in 1978. So if I was to give you a playlist of five songs that just guaranteed just going to get you into Van Halen, I'm going to go from both lead singer eras, because you had David Lee Roth was their lead singer for 6 years, and then there was a very public acrimonious split, and then they got Sammy Hagar for another decade. So for Roth, I'm going to give you Jump is just too much fun, and it's just too irresistible to not enjoy. The track right after that in 1984 is Panama, and that's also great. I would give you Ain't Talking About Love, because it's just an all-time guitar banger. I would give you Unchained, but then I'll also give you my favorite Van Halen song of all time, which isn't the hardest rocker, but it just hits that sweet spot, Dance the Night Away. If you need a good summertime jam for this coming summer, Dance the Night Away is the answer.
Okay.
And so I'll put a couple Sammy Hagar era songs in there for you too. I'll give you Dreams, I'll give you Top of the World, and I'll give you Right Now, which is an anthem that if you've ever been in a sports arena since 1991, you've heard Right Now.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. And do you have any other bands besides Van? Because I know Van Halen's like, you know, like the back of your hand. But are there any other groups? Like, because I don't know, I just find that interesting, because my generation, classic rock, it's either, if you do like classic rock, it's like Led Zeppelin or,
yeah,
you know, but are there any other groups that you're really passionate about? Not to the same degree, obviously.
Zeppelin's right up there. Zeppelin's okay. Probably in my top five. I would put Aerosmith way up there. The Beatles are probably my second favorite band of all time behind Van Halen. Growing up in the Southeast, it's impossible to resist Lynyrd Skynyrd. They're more than just Sweet Home Alabama and Freebird, I promise. And so I'll really run the gamut of rock and roll into the blues. I can appreciate hip hop and country. I can enjoy a good jazz club, but I always come back to, like, at some point in my day, I'm going to need to hear a kick-ass guitar riff. That's just, it's just, everybody has a certain kind of music that is just in their blood, and that's just what makes it pump. And for me, it's just a great, great guitar artist. And for my money, there's never been anyone better than Eddie Van Halen.
Yeah. And so then, you know, you also mentioned Led Zeppelin, and I mentioned, but are you a fan of Greta Van Fleet, the younger group?
Yeah. And it's actually a really exciting time in rock. And it's been a minute since rock fans have been able to say that about new bands popping up. So Greta Van Fleet is great. They have a Zeppelin-y kind of sound to them, with a little bit of an occasional, like, Black Crowes, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Southern rock roots. The same thing can be said. If you like Greta Van Fleet, you got to check out this band Dirty Honey that's been tearing up Southern California. They sound a little similar to they have, like, Zeppelin vibes. They have a little bit of, like, early Aerosmith in them. They really can rock. And you know, you have I'm trying to think of all these other band. Aaron Jones is another guy who's coming up, who's just got great stuff. Rival Sons is a Long Beach band that has now gone nationwide, and they're touring, you know, headlining all across the world. And so it's kind of like a little comeback right now for rock, and I'm enjoying it. It's something I never thought I'd see in the mainstream the way that it was back in the 60s and 70s and 80s.
And do you hear Blues Traveler at all in Greta Van Fleet? Because that's the one, you know, of course, Led Zeppelin's the main one, but I hear a little bit of Blues Traveler, at least on their first album.
Yeah. It's you get a little bit of that, I guess you could call it harmonica rock, for lack of a better word. But Blues Travelers, it's just one of those bands that always put a smile on your face, you know? You're looking for a band that just makes you happy. It doesn't have to be the deepest message. Blues Traveler can get there, and they can get pretty jam bandy. They sort of remind me of an Allman Brothers sort of. Allman Brothers would be another good one for you to check out if you like the Greta Van Fleet and Blues Travelers of the world. Then I would encourage you to just look at who their influences were, because that's probably going to sound more the same, and that's good news.
Yeah. Oh, and before, you know, do you have any sort of hard out in the next, you know, 10 minutes or 15
No,
minutes?
Man.
Okay, perfect. Before I get to the schmodown, I did want to ask a question I forgot to ask earlier, which was, do you have any advice for people that want to get into stand-up? My roommate, for example, last semester, I believe, was very close to doing an open mic. Circumstances didn't allow it, but he is funny. But I'm just curious, you know, you've done it, right? You have a special out there, and you do it almost every night. I see you always at the promoting the Comedy Store. So I'd love to hear, you know, what you tell people when they want to get into stand-up.
Well, against my religion is helping out a Cowboys fan, but I guess if I was to give advice to the world of young folks who are thinking about maybe trying stand-up, my only piece of advice is stealing from Nike, and it's just do it. You have to get up. You can anticipate, you can try to write, you can work stuff out on your friends, much to their chagrin after a while. But at some point, you just got to take that leap of faith. It's like the end of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, where Indiana Jones goes through all these different trials to get to the precipice of the room where the Holy Grail is. It's right there, but there's no bridge to get him there. And so he realizes, oh, it's a leap of faith, and you just got to take that first step. And it works out okay for him. And however it works out is, you have to remember that it's not the end point. It's the starting line. Yeah. So it's much better to stumble a little bit out of the gates than it is to trip right before you cross the finish line of a marathon. So you're just starting out. It's okay. However it goes, just do your best, be honest. And I always say, when you're trying to write jokes, especially starting out, don't try to be funny. Just try to be honest, and you'll find the funny in there, but just write something honest, come up with an honest premise, and the funny will find itself.
Okay. Yeah, no, I think that is great advice. And I'm sure the other thing is that you're going to fail, right? I think my roommate also says this a lot, that, you know, you have to fail forward, because otherwise you can't learn, you know, from your mistakes. Cause I'm sure, you know, you mentioned it earlier, you've had a joke bomb before, right? Or
many,
you can think of the Rocky example.
Yeah.
In a public speech.
It's really the test of someone, if they can learn from their mistakes, because it's really easy to celebrate your wins. Like if you do stand up for the first time and you have a good set, great, congratulations. But you learn a lot more from the bad ones. You learn a lot more from that game film that you go back and you say, oh, that's what I should have done differently. Oh, I was talking too fast. I was saying after every word. I wasn't making eye contact with the crowd. I didn't move the mic stand out of the way. Like, there's just so many little things that you can watch other people do it, and you can sort of study their technique, but you have to find your own technique. You don't want to be a birthday party impressionist of another comedian. You have to find your own voice. And the only way to do that is to be on stage talking. It's not just hanging out with your friends, because there's people that are way more funny than me at parties in groups of people. And I was just the guy who had the need to get on stage for whatever reason, see if I can make people laugh. And it's sort of a different art form than it is just making cracks with your friends. They're both great, but they're both very different.
Well, and I do want to ask you about that. But do you what is your, because I don't know, I just, this question came to my mind. Do you have, like, with the mic stand, for example, you know, every rock lead vocalist or every stand-up comic does something different with it, right? You know, like Bono, for example, U2's my favorite band. You know, he's playing around with the mic stand all the time. Comics aren't going to necessarily do that. But, you know, what do you do with it on stage? And do you use like a stool? I'm trying to think back to your special. I can't remember.
There is a bunch of different things that I like to do. I'm a little kinetic with my movements on stage. I'm not jumping all over the place, but I also really like U2. I feel like it's sort of a smorgasbord of everything, but I take the mic out of the stand initially.
Okay.
More often than not, I'll get up there, and that's just the comfort zone for me, is take the mic out of the stand. So if you just want to tell jokes with a mic in the stand, that's fine. Do that. But if you take it out of the stand, then take the stand and put it in the corner of the stage, because otherwise it just looks weird. It's blocking you. It kind of looks like an amateurish move. But there's also one of the best comics in the world right now. Bill Burr loves to take the mic out of the stand, move the stand a couple feet one way or the other, and then he'll rest his elbow on it as he's talking. And so it's sort of like, you know, him pulling up to a bar stool or something and just kind of leaning in and giving you his opinion. There's other comics that feel way more at home sitting down. Chris Rock is a guy who, when he's working material out, he just kind of comes up very, very cool, collected, doesn't make a big, you know, show about it like you would see on one of his specials. And he just sits on the stool and he's just there to mold. He's just there to chip away at an idea until he finds where the beats are, where he finds the funny. Ken Napsok, who's been on the road with me a fair amount when I go out in the past year, he sort of found that he just wasn't as comfortable standing up as he is sitting on a stool. So he just kind of likes to sit on the stool and talk. And I'll have moments in my set where, especially if I'm doing a longer set, that I like sitting down, just because it kind of changes the energy. It's kind of like, now we're all going to talk about this one little secret thing. So Mark's sitting on the stool. It's like you're around a campfire, but you just kind of learn what your rhythm is and how you react to different situations, whether you're holding a mic or sitting down or whatever it is. And changing the energy of a crowd and keeping them on their toes is part of holding their attention for an hour.
Yeah. And I think you did mention Bill Burr's, which when you said it, I instantly could picture. I'd seen one of his specials recently. Yeah. And I always thought of that as, I'm going to reference you too again, but that was like the Bono on the Edge, you know, like as if you're holding on to your guitarist right next to you. That's what it
right,
always
reminded right.
me. But yeah. I think yours is probably more realistic, what he's going for, the more, you know, at the bar or whatever. But the U2 comparison always came to my mind. Are you a fan of the album that was on everybody's phone, Songs of Innocence? Did you listen to that one? Because I have to defend that on a like almost a daily basis, it feels like.
Yeah, I still have it. I when I'm driving around, I just usually toss the old phone on shuffle, and I'll just see. And I have a lot of U2 on my phone, as it turns out. And so Songs of Innocence, I believe, is that the one with Get On Your Boots on it?
That's No Line on the Horizon.
That's No Line on the Horizon. All right. Really like No Line on the Horizon. The one that everybody got for free. There's a couple tracks off there that I enjoyed, but No Line on the Horizon was just like, holy crap, that was great. Really? And then How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb before that might be. It's almost Octung Baby for me. Octung Baby, really? I still think is my favorite U2 album of all time, but okay. How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb is way up there.
I find that so both of those, How to Dismantle an Atomic Bomb and No Line on the Horizon, I just find that interesting. I don't think usually U2 fans are the biggest on those. I'm more basic. I love the Joshua Tree. And I got to write a rhetorical analysis on that won an award last year. So that was like my crowning achievement as a U2 fan, to write a paper on them and get to present that at a conference and whatever.
You got to bring, is it a physical award? You got to bring it to a U2 show. Bono needs to see this.
I know. Well, okay, so I'm trying hard. He's getting some award in D.C. later this month, and it seems like he's going to be there. And I'm hoping, I was like trying to pull the strings as a press member. I was like, can I please get in? I totally would mention that because I have the plaque sitting in my bathroom. No, I don't know where else to put it.
Hell yeah.
But yeah, it would be really cool. But not to get
Keep me posted on that venture. I want to know how this ends up. I got a good feeling about this.
Okay, well, if you have a good feeling, then I feel better about it.
Use me as a reference. Whatever I can do to get you and Bono in the same room, I will do it.
Oh, well, that's always great to hear. Thank you so much for that. And all right, well, I'll get the Schmodown to stop. You know, I could talk about U2 for way too, probably as long as you could talk about Van Halen. But the Schmodown now, are you guys is it season 9 or season 10?
We are in season 9. Yeah, okay. Officially season 9. Started as just a button at the end of our podcast. And now it's just grown to this full-fledged movie trivia sport that is just, you know, has really sort of blown up, and I can take the least amount of credit for it, but I do enjoy still, after all these years, calling the matches and announcing it and getting to hang with the personalities after a long shoot day. It just, it really is a tightly knit community, and it's fun to see how many people it means so much to, because I never would have expected that.
Yeah. So are you guys back into studio matches? I was trying to think of the term.
It's a nice studio. It's like a full-fledged TV production now, where the virtual era is how we refer to during the pandemic, when everybody was doing matches like you and I are, where we're at separate places and we got to do it online. And it was crucial to maintain the show and the show's momentum. Like without this sort of technology, the show would have probably just gone away permanently. But the fact that was able to sustain us, and now we're back in studio, you just see how happy everybody is to actually physically be around one another. And we do it safely. We still have testing on site, but it feels like, knock on wood, we're getting back to being able to tour with doing live matches all over the country, hopefully the world. And then, bringing that excitement, because it's that enthusiasm that you can't fully replicate in a virtual sense, much like doing stand-up. It might be fun if you're a fan of somebody to see them perform something virtually, but if you're there in the crowd, in the front row, and they're right there, whether it's stand-up, it's a U2 concert, or it's movie trivia that you're obsessed with the storylines and the competition aspect of it, then it means that much more when you can physically be there and just feel like you're part of something.
Well, it had to be hard digitally, because I remember watching the matches, and you run the risk of internet problems or technicality glitches or whatever, and the production is just a completely different thing. You guys would have to use like a virtual wheel, right? And I don't remember if you and Christian would be in the same location. I think you guys would be separate, right?
Yeah. We'd all be separate, and there were many frustrations with internet connectivity. There's a couple people I could out by name, but I won't. they just always have some sort of issue. And it's just, people playing on their phones at a coffee shop. And it was very trying and frustrating. I think I held mine in better than Christian did. Because by the end of the run, every week, Christian's like, I can't do this anymore. And I'm like, all right, we're almost through this. We have a very parental relationship with the show. And so sometimes mommy and daddy got to go work their issues out. And that's just what that era did to us. But I feel like we all feel completely reinvigorated now, getting to do it the way that we used to, the way that we want to present the show in studio, to the world online, and everywhere in between. It feels like we're doing it the way that particularly Christian had always envisioned it. And that's pretty satisfying to finally be able to say.
And are you guys doing the live events in New York and California again? Like, I know you mentioned studio, but I remember you guys would have like the big theater venues and stuff.
Yeah, we love doing those. It's my favorite part of the job, really, but we're sort of taking it easy. It's a little bit like my touring schedule with stand-up, where you just want to be a little cagey about booking too much too soon. You never know if another variant is going to surge or what it's going to be. It feels like we're sort of getting back to normal-ish, but I think that we're going to take it light for this season. So we'll probably do a few live shows that may be local in LA at theaters, and then try to ramp up touring maybe at the end of the season. Who knows what the future holds, but definitely by season 10, I hope we can get back to some markets that have been great to us, like a New York, but also get to some other places that we've been wanting to go. I mean, we've been wanting to hit Philly, we've been wanting to hit Boston for a long time. And so hopefully we can finally make those appearances come to pass.
Yeah. And speaking of Christian, this Heat poster behind me is much due thanks to him. I remember it was his early in COVID. I remember listening to SCN Live. He would do his Pacino impression from Heat. And after a while, I was like, I didn't really know who Al Pacino was at this point. And I was like, I have to now see this movie. And it's become one of my favorite movies. All my friends, I annoy them with the amount I send the Dunkachino meme, if you know, or in the video, or I think that's my name on PlayStation. So I think, but it was always that impression. And it got me into such a fandom of Al Pacino that now he's like my favorite actor. But it was this Heat, it's this scene here that I always think of with SCN Live in the early COVID days because of the impressions of Pacino.
Yeah, he loves that movie, and Pacino goes for it, man. I mean, he has a ball in a movie. And I think it makes the movie more fun to watch again and again, because you just know that there are certain scenes that come in when Al is just going to go so over the top, but he's Pacino and he just makes it work. And so it's so far-fetched that he's reacting to these situations like that, but it also just oddly feels perfectly in place with the events that are happening. So Heat is a trip to go back and revisit, man. Plus, like, De Niro's so good at about, yes. Kilmer is such a badass. Danny Trejo, it's like, it's got such a stellar cast. It is definitely worth checking out.
Yeah. And did you see House of Gucci? I have to ask, you know, mentioning over the top Pacino.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. There were a few over the top performances in House of Gucci, but yes. He always gives it 110%. Doesn't matter if he's doing a prestige project like that or if he's doing Jack and Jill. I mean, the guy commits. That's what you can say about Al Pacino. Yeah, and it's like, because again, you're being introduced to him through more of his more modern stuff. And even I probably first really knew who he was from like Scent of a Woman or something like that. And then you go back and you see how great he can be when he is more grounded. Like in the Godfather movies, he's just, oh my God, he's so good. And you're like, oh, that's why this guy is known as one of the all-time greats, because he can do all of this stuff.
Yes. Yeah, and not just Dunkachino, as great as that one is.
Dunkachino is pretty great. It's pretty memorable, though.
Well, the actual suit he wore is on eBay for $5,000. I happened to say that was sent, you know, I saw that on eBay. So it's a tempting purchase. But to let you go, you know, I just want to ask you, do you remember the last couple of movies you've seen? You know, I think you might have saw Batman recently or...
Yeah, I think the last two movies that I've seen for the first time, in the midst of all the March Madness and NFL free agency coverage and true crime documentaries that I'm obsessed with, Turning Red and The Batman. And those are probably the toughest two movies to compare one to the other one, but I loved Turning Red. I had so much fun with it. I love all of the you know, debating online about, can we show a girl who might be getting her period in a Pixar movie? And it's like, did you all forget that for the last century, Disney's been killing off parents in the first 5 minutes of every one of their movies? Like, that doesn't bother you, but a girl maturing naturally, that's what pisses people off. And then The Batman, I think I was more impressed by it than I actually enjoyed it. And again, I've only seen it once, so maybe, you know, us movie fans tend to rewatch these comic book things ad nauseum, but I felt the length of it. And I've talked to a lot of friends who thought that the movie just flew by. It didn't for me. I felt the length of it, but there was not a bad performance or even a mediocre performance in the house. Everybody went for it. I liked that it was a different spin on Batman / Bruce Wayne. I thought Zoe stole the movie as Catwoman. I thought the Penguin was great. So there's a lot to love in there. Matt Reeves did a hell of a job seeing his vision to the screen. I'm excited to see where we go from here. It was a little wearing. It was a little dreary. You know, I after I got out of the movie, Andrew, I felt like I lived in Gotham City and I just wanted a shower and a vacation. And I was just tired of being rained on, because you think Seattle's rainy, Gotham City gets hit, man.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And just, you know, have to burn all your Nirvana albums and all after. And with Colin Farrell in the movie, did you think, cause all I could think of the whole time he was on screen, I kept thinking it reminded me so much of not Pacino, De Niro in The Untouchables. And I had talked to somebody who thought that was an amazing comparison. And it's just all I could see, just not just the, you know, the prosthetics and stuff, but even like his dialect was very De Niro like.
Yeah. The way that he spoke is sort of the way that he carried himself was it did feel just like, honestly, like Al Capone, who De Niro's playing in The Untouchables. And I heard a story that they did a makeup test with Colin Farrell. And then he actually, I guess they were downtown in Burbank, a stone's throw from my place. And that's where they did the makeup test. And so Colin Farrell just decided to go walk down Main Street of Burbank and just see if anybody, and nobody recognized him. And he just, I think he probably like popped into a coffee shop and got something. Nobody was any the wiser. It was just this super famous movie star in a whole lot of makeup. So, you know, God bless him for signing on to that HBO Max show. That's going to be a spinoff. That's going to see him in the makeup chair a lot longer, but if he's up for it, I'm up for watching it.
Yeah, and I don't know if I'm allowed to do this, but can I ask you for your rating of the films then, out of, you know, however many schmoes would you give it?
Man, at Turning Red, I think I'd easily give like 4.5 out of 5 schmoes too. With the Batman, I think I'd give it with all the effort involved and just like how impressed and moody the movie was. I think it'd be a crime to give it less than 4 out of 5 schmoes. It personally didn't, it wasn't my favorite style of a Batman movie, but you know, we all go through different moods and different emotions in our lives. And so there may be a time when I'm like, that's the Batman I feel like rewatching. You know, I don't always need to put on the Michael Keaton one or Chris Nolan one. I can put that one on if I'm in the right mood. So I'll give it 4 out of 5 schmoes. I'll go back to my classic schmoes days and I'll give it 4.01 out of 5 schmoes. I'll go to the decimal points for you.
All right. Well, I feel very honored by that. Is there any, where can people find you on Twitter? And do you want to plug, you know, the Schmodown and all that?
Sure. Yeah. You can check out the movie Trivia Schmodown on YouTube is probably the easiest hub to find us. I have a show on Peacock. I host a couple different shows on Peacock for Rotten Tomatoes. They've been pretty good to me. And social media is at Mark Ellis Live, and tour dates when they get announced is markellis.live. So it's all one centralized symbiotic Mark Ellis Live is probably where you'll find all my stuff.
Perfect. Well, it was a blast talking to you. And I really, it was such an honor to actually get to meet you instead of just talking to you over email. Thank you so much for all of your time.
Yeah, man. I'm sorry I kept you waiting so long. And so I guess what we need to do is we need a bet as far as our teams are going to meet twice, unless we meet in the playoffs, which probably is going to happen. So let's bet on that first meeting, that first Giants Commanders game. What's the bet?
Ooh.
I got it. I think I know what it is. When we see each other in person, the loser has to buy the winner a Dunkachino or the closest,
yes.
The closest possible beverage that we can find at a coffee shop to the famous call from Heat.
Yes. I love that. That's beautiful. It's a beautiful way to wrap it up. Al Pacino always closes things out. Well, thank you again, Mark, for all of your time.
Thank you, Andrews. It was great finally getting to connect with you. And I look forward to Carson Wentz winning me a Dunkachino this fall.